We're right. Appeal 1593, the State of Wisconsin Local Government Property Insurance Fund versus Lexington Insurance Company versus Cincinnati Insurance Company. Oh boy. Come on up, Mr. Canaris.
Good morning. May it please the court.
That's what you think. Or, go ahead.
Hey, it's 60 degrees out in the middle of February. It's a good morning.
Yeah, well, look at what we're saddled with. We could be out there playing.
Your Honor, please the court. Lexington's appealing the denial of the motion to compel arbitration. And the trial court below and appellees here are confusing the standard to determine whether an issue is arbitratable. They've gone out of their way, the trial court did, to find perceived ambiguities and then construed those ambiguities and resolved them against arbitration, which is contrary to the standard.
Yeah, but the triggering event for arbitration in the joint loss agreement is the payment of one half of the amount in dispute when requested by the county. So how is it that Lexington has a right to arbitrate under this clause when it never made the payment?
Respectfully, that's not the triggering agreement. If we look at the clause itself, and I'm going to go to both joint loss agreements.
Now, is Mr. Sampson going to disagree with that? No. It's okay. Oh, good. Okay.
If I look at the joint loss agreement, which is, first of all parties agree that this joint loss agreement is in the Lexington policy. It's part of the policy. The court concluded that it's not contested on appeal. So this joint loss agreement that's in the Lexington policy says, and the first paragraph is the operative paragraph, in the event of damage to or destruction of property at a location designated in this policy, and also designated in the boiler and machinery insurance policy, there is a disagreement between the insurers with respect to, one, whether the damage was caused by apparel insured against by this policy or apparel insured by the boiler and machinery policy, and then the extent of the damage caused by the peril under the boiler and machinery or the peril under the all risk. That is the gateway question that the Seventh Circuit, that this court has said, is the question of arbitrability. You have to look at the formation of the contract and when the contract was entered into. And the issue is this the type of dispute which should be an arbitration? And this is exactly the type of dispute that falls within this provision.
But what
fire is covered under the all-risk policy. Electrical breakdown and the damage caused by the electrical breakdown and the equipment breakdown is covered by the boiler and machinery policy. And the two carriers, the three carriers, the one tower being the property carriers and the other being the boiler and machinery, disagree about the extent to which the damage was caused either by fire or by the electrical or mechanical breakdown. So that's the triggering event. The payment part that you're talking about, Your Honor, that's the procedural issue. That is the mechanism by which the policyholder is made whole and extricated from this process so that the two insurers, the two towers of coverage, the property on one side and the boiler and machinery on the other, can address in arbitration the dispute.
But doesn't it say, it says that the payments by the insurers herein and acceptance of the same by the insured signify the agreement of the insurers to submit and proceed with arbitration. And that's really, that's the operative portion here. If you want to have either the obligation or the duty or the right to arbitrate, you've got to pay up, right? You got to ante up to get in the game, right?
And they did ante up. Lexington paid $5 million.
What was that for?
At the time, unfortunately, the record is very undeveloped because we moved to compel without having a chance to answer or any discovery. But the $5 million was paid as a cash advance, without prejudice to their rights to seek recovery of it. It was based on a view that some of the damage may have been caused by fire. And it was to allow Lexington, really, to conduct its investigation and determine what the cause of the loss was. That's what the facts will bear out. But, Your Honor, getting back to the 90-day point, that comes under Section 2 of this joint loss agreement, which is the mechanism by which the policyholder, the underlying insurer, is made whole. We weren't allowed to participate in that discussion because Boiler and Machinery Carrier and the fund met with the county, Milwaukee County, by themselves. We didn't even know that they were going to be arbitrating this issue until we were served with the complaint. And that's the first notice that we heard that they were invoking the arbitration. We're happy to participate in that arbitration. We should be entitled to. If we're not entitled to, then this joint loss agreement, which is part of our policy that everybody agrees, has no meaning. That's a procedural issue that the court that you've raised about how the payment issue and how the insured is made whole. And if I can turn...
And you'll be relitigating all of the underlying claims that were resolved between the fund and Cincinnati.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't
understand. You'll relitigate all of the claims is what you want.
No, what we want to do is arbitrate the issue of the extent of the damage caused by electrical breakdown or mechanical breakdown. That's what should be...
Are you talking about the $1.6 million?
Your Honor, no, we believe that the loss is greater than $1.6
million. Okay, that's why you want to get in then.
Yes, and if you look at the joint loss, and if I can point out to the joint loss agreement in Cincinnati's policy, which you have to construe both of these together, appellees didn't quote paragraph D3 in their brief, and I think that's very telling. What D3 says is payments by the insurers of the amount that are in disagreement as described in 1 and 2 do not alter, waive, or surrender any rights of any insurer against each other with regard to the portion of the loss for which insurer is liable. In other words, even though Cincinnati and the fund may have come to the conclusion that or agreement that only $1.6 million is in dispute, that clause makes clear that in the arbitration, the arbitrators are free to decide more than the $1.6 million. No insurer is waiving their rights to claim more by invoking, by paying the insured one half. The whole point of this, and we have to really step back, what is the goal of the joint loss agreement? The goal of the joint loss agreement is to make the policyholder whole, that being the county, not let them be involved in the litigation, let them be on their way, and then let the insurance companies resolve their dispute as to how the loss should be apportioned, what was the cause of the loss, and how that should be apportioned, and they've agreed to do that in arbitration.
Who does Lexington pay when there's a loss?
Lexington pays the fund, who pays the individual governmental unit. The individual governmental unit, let's step back here for 1 second. Hypothetically, let's assume that the fund was insolvent. The county would come to Lexington as the excess carrier and say, we have a loss, you owe us above $1.8 million for this loss, it's covered in the policy. Lexington would not deny coverage because of the notion that the county is not an insured under its policy. While the fund is the named insured, the policy makes clear that the members, the participating members, and that's an endorsement A, that are insured in the fund policies are covered. And in that situation, Lexington would pay. If it went, it would be subject to breach of contract and potential extra contractual claims. So I think that the trial court below got a little bit hung up on the issue of whether or not the county was an insured, and the fact that the county didn't specifically reach out to Lexington to participate in the arbitration. Well, one, we were excluded from those discussions. Two, the Lexington policy clearly insures the interest of the county and its property. The statement of values that we included in the appendix are made a part of the policy based on the occurrence of limit liability language. And it clearly shows the county's property as insured property underneath there. And the only fair interpretation that you should have about the where it says the insured requests arbitration is once the county requested payment invoking the arbitration clause under the primary policy, it should have invoked it under the excess policy. Triggering it under the primary triggers it under the excess. Otherwise, this joint loss agreement would have no force in effect.
So this is why Lexington is not a reinsurer.
Lexington's not a reinsurer. Well, first let's look at the plain language of the policy. Lexington's policy insures all risks of direct physical loss unless otherwise excluded that happen during the policy period. That's a direct insurance. There is no follow the fortunes language. There is no follow the settlements language. The language of the policy in many...
Is it common to have follow form language?
Yes, it is. And there's no Wisconsin case whatsoever that, and plaintiffs admit, that that say that you imply those in terms into a reinsurance agreement, if it was a reinsurance agreement, which it's not. And if we look at other parts of the policy, if you look under the deductible section of the Lexington policy, it refers to the underlying policy. In the very insuring agreement on Exhibit A, it says that other coverages and extensions of coverages provided by the state of Wisconsin local government property insurance fund to participating members, the county, is further described in the policy form and then makes that policy form part of its policy. The deductible clause refers to the underlying policy deductible. Special conditions states that this policy is subject to any changes by endorsement in the primary insurance policy. The primary insurance policy is the fund's policy, which in any manner affects this policy, and it shall be furnished to, those copies should be furnished to Lexington. And then later on it says, perils are added to reflect same specified causes of loss as the underlying LGPIF policy.
What may be added, I'm sorry, perils?
Yes, under the pollution and contamination
endorsement,
it points out and it changes the primary form and makes it consistent, the excess policy consistent with the primary form. Then there's other parts here where it also says it, there's just no evidence whatsoever based on the language of the policy that it's reinsurance.
How can the Lexington policy be a commercial property policy if the insured under the policy is the fund? In other words, another insurer and holds no property.
Because the fund is charged with purchasing as part of its mandate, can purchase insurance on behalf of the governmental unit. So that gives it an insurable interest in procuring insurance. In addition, the Lexington policy is insuring each of the individual governmental units across the state of Wisconsin that participate in the fund and do adjust and investigate claims directly. I mean, to argue that Lexington is a reinsurer is, I think the allegations of the complaint, for example, show that there's no basis for that. On the extra contractual claims, there's an allegation that Lexington didn't investigate timely, that they had all this opportunity to evaluate and inspect and determine the cause, and it took them too long to do that. That's not an obligation of a reinsurer. That's an obligation of a direct insurer. The fund knows that Lexington was a direct insurer, and the affidavit that we've appended from the underwriter makes clear that this was a direct policy because the fund approached them and said, for the next year, 2015, we want you to write reinsurance for the first time. And we sent out a letter canceling the direct policy and that saying that we were going to submit...
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's document 28-4, the affidavit of Pinnett Josa, and it also includes the manuscript form that Lexington would have issued if it was a reinsurance policy.
I've used up all your time by asking questions, but I do have another question.
Sure.
And I will give you the time. Don't worry.
Okay.
If Lexington is an excess loss insurer, then shouldn't it be the case that it had no liability whatsoever until the fund's entire $2.5 billion primary coverage limit was exhausted?
No, Your Honor, because the way this program was written, and we have to look at the policy the way it was written, is that Lexington became responsible once the loss exceeded $1.8 million.
Well, that's way down at the bottom then. You're not talking about this. I also understood that there was some kind
My time is up. But
it's not
up. Okay.
I mean, when we're talking, you know.
Well, but you're talking about the 1.8, when anything in excess of 1.8 million?
If it's covered.
This is what, 18 million or 19 or something?
Up to the Lexington limit. This program, by the way.
Which is? Up to the Lexington limit, which is?
I don't have it off the top of my head. Okay. I'll look at the policy while I'm gone. But I do know that this is a tower program, so that there are excess policies above Lexington's layer that go all the way up to the $2.5 billion. Lexington doesn't go all the way up to $2.5 billion. Well, I think it stops at
$100
million.
Where are they sandwiched in? That's what I'm trying to figure out. What's for instance, you know, the policy limits on, I guess, Cincinnati and the funds. Underlying whatever, I don't know whether it's
the way
even in an excess situation.
The way this policy was written is that I think Lexington had responsibility from $1.8 million to $100 million. And then above $100 million, the fund actually has other insurance from other excess insurance from Travelers and other carriers up to the $2.5 billion.
We're talking about something around 18, 19 million, right?
Yes.
So theoretically, then Lexington kicked in a long time ago.
It did, Your Honor, and that's why we paid what we believed at the time, based on the information that was available, that this would be the most that Lexington would owe as a result of fire versus electrical breakdown, electrical arcing.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Mr. Sampin.
May it please the court, my name is Don Sampin. I represent Cincinnati Insurance Company. Mr. Silver, who represents the fund, and I are splitting up the appellee's portion of this. I'm going to take 8 minutes. He'll take 7 minutes. I'm going to try to focus on the reinsurance issues for Your Honor. Mr. Silver is going to try to focus on the conditions in the JLA, the Joint Loss Agreement. Of course, if Your Honor has other questions that goes outside that, we'll try to respond as best we can. But that's what our focus on for purposes of the argument today. As Mr. Canaris pointed out, there is a disagreement between the parties concerning whether Lexington is a reinsurer or an excess insurer. That was a disagreement that was addressed by the district court, but not decided for purposes of resolving the issue before it. We would agree with the district court that reaching that issue isn't necessarily critical for purposes of this court to affirm the district court. We nevertheless believe that finding that Lexington is a reinsurer provides an additional compelling justification for this court to affirm. So let me address first why we think Lexington is a reinsurer, and then I'll talk about why it makes a difference here. And that goes directly to Mr. Canaris's point that he said that if they can't participate in the arbitration, then the JLA has no meaning at all. Well, we disagree with that. We think it has a very important meaning. But let me just summarize the reasons why we think that Lexington is regarded as a reinsurer here. The main one, of course, is, as Your Honors have already discussed with Mr. Canaris, Lexington's insured is another insurer, i.e. the fund. And Lexington insures the fund not for the fund's tort liabilities, but for the payments that the fund makes to the county as a result of property losses of the county. And that relationship fits perfectly into the definition of reinsurance as set forth by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in the Ott versus Alstor case that we've cited in the brief. There are other indications here as well that Lexington is a reinsurer. And some of these you've discussed with Mr. Canaris. One is the fact that the county, the ultimate insured here, has no contract, has no privity of contract with Lexington. That's very common in reinsurance relationships. The county has no right to sue the Lexington based upon a contract relationship because there is no contract relationship. When Lexington paid a portion of the loss here, the $5 million that you've discussed with Mr. Canaris, it wasn't paid to the county. It was paid to Lexington's reinsured, the fund. The Lexington policy also was triggered here well before the exhaustion of the fund policy. And that's all indicative of a reinsurance relationship. Now, we point out in our brief that the Lexington policy is not a model of clarity. And there are certain language in that policy that Mr. Canaris is able to seize upon to argue, well, we're really an excess insurer. But we think that if you take the policy as a whole, you elevate substance over form, and you take into account particularly the fact that it's insured was another insurance company. The only reasonable conclusion here is that Lexington is a reinsurer.
You know, I have been wondering. Everyone spent a lot of time on the issue. Is a definitive answer as to whether Lexington is a reinsurer really important here?
Well, as I indicated, Judge Rovner, we think it's not critical to make that determination to affirm. We think it provides a very important reason for affirming, however. And Judge Stattmuller didn't think it necessary to reach that issue, and he decided that Lexington was not entitled to participate. As Mr. Silver will further talk with you about, we think that Judge Stattmuller was absolutely correct. We also think, though, that finding that Lexington is a reinsurer is important as well.
So, in other words, I think what you're saying is it's not critical that we declare whether Lexington is a reinsurer or an excess insurer in order to resolve the case. Is that what you're saying?
Essentially, yes, Your Honor. It is not essential for Your Honors to affirm Judge Stattmuller. We think it's important, however, we think it's a very important issue for one of the reasons that Mr. Canaris said. And that is that the JLA still has meaning, still has importance here, even if Lexington is not able to participate in the arbitration. And that is because Lexington is bound by the outcome of the arbitration. And that's why it makes a difference here as to whether or not Lexington is a reinsurer. It's bound by the outcome by virtue of the follow the settlements and follow the fortunes doctrines, which we think have general applicability to reinsurers. But in addition, they have particular application here because Lexington has acknowledged that it has incorporated the JLA, the Joint Loss Agreement endorsement, into its policy. And it further takes the position, it has admitted here, it's contended here, that the JLA covers the coverage disputes among the parties here. We agree that the JLA covers the coverage disputes currently at issue among the parties. The JLA is in the nature of a settlement procedure, provides for arbitration. We think that the parties are bound by the outcome of the arbitration and that Lexington in particular is bound.
Would they want to intervene in the arbitration? That's the issue before.
Well, they're trying to intervene in the arbitration.
And what's the reason they shouldn't be able to?
I'm sorry?
Why should they not be able to intervene? It seems that that's why we're here.
The reason is, one, you read the specific language of the JLA, the specific conditions that Judge Rovner raised at the outset, and you'll find that Lexington doesn't fit as one of the persons who is entitled to arbitrate. But in addition, if you take a look not just at the conditions, but two other words that are important in the JLA, and those two words that I want to focus on are insured and insurer. I want to focus on those words because it is insurers that have the right and entitlement to arbitrate under the JLA. And in order to determine who the insurers are, you have to determine who the insured is. Now, there's no dispute here that as the JLAs appear in the fund and Cincinnati policies, the county is the insured. And Cincinnati and the fund are the insurers. No dispute about that at all. The only possible dispute here is once the JLA is incorporated into the Lexington policy, do those words change in meaning? And they do not, for two reasons. One is the fact that Lexington's own brief concedes that the word insured, as it appears in the JLA, in the Lexington policy, continues to refer to the county. It talks about the insured as being the property owner, the insured as being the one who's entitled to ultimate payment here. And the only property owner here is the county. And if the county is the insured, the only two insurers here are the fund in Cincinnati. And how do I know that? I know that because if you look at the declarations page of the Lexington policy, it's insured is not the county. It's insured is the fund. And the second reason why the JLA does not permit arbitration, does not permit Lexington to participate in the arbitration, is that the JLA refers to insurers. And Wisconsin law draws a distinction between insurers and reinsurers. Lexington is not an insurer. It is a reinsurer, and therefore has no right to participate.
Thank you.
I see that my time is up. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honors, unless you have questions. You. Thank you.
I hope all of that is just your blankie.
Your Honor, it's just to make me feel comfortable.
I know.
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Silver, and I'm counsel for the State of Wisconsin Local Government Property Insurance Fund. I'd like to address three issues in my time. Number one is the threshold issue of arbitrability, which Lexington raises in its briefing. Lexington's position is that it is for an arbitration panel to determine whether the issue of its right to participate is itself something that should be determined instead of being determined by this court. Now then,
that's your first issue, but how would it harm Milwaukee County and its ability to be paid expeditiously if Lexington were to be a party to the arbitration?
You mean how would it affect the fund?
Yeah.
Because the fund has the right to have a court determine what Lexington owes the fund. This principle is set forth in the Sphere Drake case, where this court said that courts, rather than arbitrators, usually determine whether the parties have agreed to arbitrate, and moreover, that arbitration is contractual, and unless the parties agree otherwise, they are entitled to have courts resolve their disputes. So it's the fund's position that it has the right to have a court resolve any dispute with Lexington unless there is something otherwise. Lexington maintains that there is something otherwise, the JLA. It's the fund's position that the JLA does not provide for any right to the Lexington to participate in any dispute between the fund and Cincinnati. And that leads to the second issue, which requires that we take a look at the JLA. Now, this court began to do that during Mr. Canaris' argument, but I'd like to return to that document since it lies at the core of the dispute. This JLA, which is at tab 4 in the short appendix, does describe that in the event of damage or destruction at a location designated in this policy, this policy is the fund policy in that event, and in the event that the property is also designated in the boiler and machinery policy, that's Cincinnati's policy, and there is a disagreement between the insurers. Well, who are the insurers? Well, here, factually, that disagreement is plainly the disagreement between the fund and Cincinnati. They are the ones who disagreed about whether one insurer or the other is responsible for the $1.6 million. Then, if that disagreement is with respect to whether the damages are from a covered peril or an apportionment or participation of one of the two policies, the fund and Cincinnati's, then this company, and that means the fund, shall, upon written request of the insured, that's the county, pay to the insured one half of the amount that's in dispute. Here, factually, that's exactly what happened. The county, that is the insured for the fund, made a written request to the fund and to Cincinnati to make payment of the $1.6 million that was in dispute. Cincinnati paid $800,000, the fund paid $800,000. And under the JLA, when that happens, then the fund and Cincinnati are permitted to have an arbitration panel resolve which of those two insurance companies are ultimately responsible for the $1.6 billion. Now, interestingly, in this JLA and the fund policy, it goes on to say that the payments by the insurers hereunder, meaning hereunder under the JLA, and acceptance of the same by the insured, the county, which did accept the $800,000 from the fund and the $800,000 from Cincinnati, signify the agreement of the insurers to submit to and proceed with arbitration. Again, that's exactly what happened. The insurers that agreed to submit to arbitration pursuant to their payments were Cincinnati and the fund. This language grants no right to Lexington to interpose its position in the arbitration process.
Would it benefit or hurt Lexington if the fund pays less or more? I mean, let's just say that the arbitration comes out where the fund pays the lion's share of the 1.6. Does that impact Lexington?
It could impact Lexington to the extent that Lexington is responsible to the fund as a reinsurer. But Lexington's rights, if any, respecting that, are something that are not resolvable by arbitration. The fact that a party may be affected by what happens in an arbitration doesn't give that party the right to participate in the arbitration. The party can still have whatever rights are available in a United States court. The whole point is that an arbitration agreement is a private agreement that allows parties in advance to take the position that specific issues can be resolved in an arbitration context instead of in court. Lexington didn't do that here. I see that I only have a minute left. I want to make two points. Number one is that Lexington takes the position that this JLA is ambiguous. It is not, based on a plain language interpretation. If it could ever be construed as ambiguous, it is only because it's incorporated into Lexington's policy, and Lexington is the company that did that. If they wanted to avoid the ambiguity that they argue that arises from incorporating the JLA into their own policy, they could have addressed that by simply making it clear when they entered into an insurance contract with the fund. They didn't do it. Final point is that under WSSTAT section 605.23, the fund manager is given all rights to determine the amount of the loss, not Lexington, and Lexington's policy incorporates Chapter 605, and therefore Lexington is bound by the statute and by its own policy.
And that policy then says whatever happens, that doesn't vary in their participation. They have to cover that.
They have to They have to be bound by the funds manager determination of the amount of the loss and the fund manager request to the Treasury of the state of Wisconsin to issue a check payable to the county for amounts that are due. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Canaris. I know, but I had to. We peppered him with questions.
Am I on borrowed
time?
Give
him his 4 minutes. What?
Am I on borrowed time? Literally. If I could just raise three quick points, and I'll try to do it quickly. And if
you
I'm
don't have to look, I you know.
Okay.
Who do you
okay.
think I am? I mean, what do you think I am? Go ahead. I'm Lady Bountiful. Go ahead.
Our arbitrability. We agree that the court's rule based on Hossam and a decision by Judge Flom and Judge Rippler is a question for the court as a gateway question. And the gateway question is this coverage dispute something that the parties agreed to arbitrate? And under the JLA, it did. It makes absolutely, it defies logic to say that the issue of the extent of coverage under the boiler machinery or the all-risk policy operates as to Cincinnati and the fund, and yet with the same provision and the same gateway decision of coverage is in our policy, we can't participate. What counsel has confused is what the court refers to in the Supreme Court exception for procedural issues. And invoking the JLA by the insured is a procedural issue. The payment is a procedural issue. Those are issues not for the court to decide, but the panel. The statute that counsel referenced does not in any way reference an insurer that provides excess coverage or even reinsurance for that matter to covered property that's damaged as a result of a covered peril. All it talks about is the authority of the fund manager under the fund policy. It in no way binds Lexington. In just a plain reading of the statute, it's a red herring, and in no way applies to Lexington. And then the last thing I just wanted to talk about was this policy. Once the JLA was incorporated into the Lexington policy, this policy refers to the Lexington policy. The named insured is the fund, but the county is an additional insured. Their interests are covered under the excess policy. They are mentioned as a group of insureds in the insuring agreement. Thank you, Your Honor, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. Thank you. Oh, you make our lives so difficult. These are very, very interesting and tricky cases. All right.